Next case is 07-2162, Kimberly Dombrowski versus Wellpoint, Inc. Ms. Richards.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. My name is Suzanne Richards, and I'm here today on behalf of Wellpoint, Inc. and Anthem Insurance Company, Inc., otherwise known as AICI. Simply stated, this case concerns the standard in Ohio for piercing the corporate veil. When a plaintiff has made a claim against a corporation, what will be the standard when the plaintiff then seeks to enforce the remedy for that claim, not against the corporation, but against another party, namely the controlling shareholder? In Belvedere, this court adopted a standard. It adopted a three-part test. First, that control of the corporation be so complete that the corporation has no separate mind, will, or existence of its own. Second, that the control be exercised in such a manner as to commit fraud or an illegal act against the person seeking to pierce the corporate veil. And third, that such control, the exercise of such control, result in an injury or an unjust act toward the plaintiff. A critical element of that test, and the critical element for this case, is the second element of that Belvedere test. And that addresses not the control issue, but how that control is exercised.
Your client, I take it, agrees that there was control here, enough control to meet the first prong of Belvedere. That's not an issue, even in the trial.
That is not an issue because it was a 12B6 motion, and we assumed for purposes of that motion control. Yeah. So the only thing that is before this court is the exercise of that control. And that element of Belvedere, we submit, has been eroded, if not completely vitiated, by various decisions of the courts of appeals, including the decision in this case. These decisions have explicitly changed, and admittedly changed, the language in Belvedere. They've expanded that language. And they've done more, however, than expand the language. They've actually changed the focus of the inquiry under the second element. While they say they're changing the language from fraud or an illegal act, they are saying, well, you could commit an unjust act, or you could commit an act that has inequitable consequences. But they really are doing more than changing the language. As the decision in this case makes clear, they are changing the focus of the inquiry under the second element of Belvedere. In veil-piercing cases, there really are two inquiries that go on. The first focuses on the underlying claim. That is, has the plaintiff alleged and ultimately proved a claim against the corporation, the controlled corporation? And whether that claim is separately prosecuted or conjoined with piercing allegations, the focus of that inquiry is on the wrong that the corporation committed against the plaintiff. And if the plaintiff alleges and proves that conduct is wrongful, it has a remedy against the corporation. And then presumably, if the corporation can pay that remedy, the case is over. In veil-piercing situations, however, the focus is not on the conduct of the corporation against the plaintiff. The focus, as required by that second prong of Belvedere, should be on the action of the controlling shareholder to the corporation or over the corporation. Was the control exercised in such a manner so that the controlling shareholder perpetrated a second wrong against the plaintiff? Did the shareholder exercise control in some fraudulent or illegal manner that so as to impair the ability or destroy the ability of the corporation to give the plaintiff the remedy it should get, having prevailed on the underlying claim? So the fraud or illegal act that is the focus of Belvedere's second test is not on the alleged act of the corporation. That is the underlying claim. It is the fraudulent or illegal act of the shareholder in controlling the corporation. What this court in Belvedere referred to as the shareholders' liability for their own misdeeds, or what Judge Kilbane in the Imperial Construction case was referring to in her dissent, I might add.
Counsel, are you saying that the shareholder has to have gained, the controlling shareholder has to have control of the corporation through fraudulent or illegal means? I think that's what I heard you say, but I wonder if that's...
No, I think what I'm saying is the shareholder has to commit its own misdeed. And
the shareholder.
The shareholder.
Right.
Because otherwise, it's an act of the corporation, and you're not making any distinction between those two. And then the concept of limited liability would be destroyed. So what I think Belvedere is doing in that second test is saying, or that second element of the test is saying, we look at the control, the exercise of the control by the shareholder over the corporation. And did the shareholder exercise that control in some fraudulent, so as to commit some fraudulent or illegal act that deprives the plaintiff of the remedy it should get against the corporation? The classic case would be, I get a claim against the corporation, I get a judgment against the corporation, and the plaintiff can't enforce that judgment because I, the controlling shareholder, closed the doors of the shareholder, closed the bank account of the, closed the doors of the corporation, closed the bank account of the corporation, transfer, and as happened in, I believe it was the Stapula and the Sanderson case, open a new corporation, giving no value for the assets that have been transferred, and simply raiding out, as in Sanderson, the corporate assets so that the plaintiff can't get its remedy against the corporation.
Ms. Richards, would you always limit it to activities that occur post-judgment? Because the example you just gave suggests that the wrongful act by the controlling shareholder occurred so that the plaintiff could not collect against the corporation. Would you see any example of a situation where the test was met before you actually got to judgment against the corporation?
Yes, the corporation, I think, if I understand your question, Your Honor, I believe that it doesn't have to be post-judgment. And in fact, there are cases where it's occurred before judgment. But it still is the focus on the act of the shareholder and not the act of the corporation.
But it sounds to me like you're saying that the act of the shareholder would be in preventing the plaintiff from getting to the corporation itself or collecting from the corporation.
Yes, I think so, Your Honor, because if the plaintiff gets a judgment against the corporation and the corporation can pay the judgment, provide the remedy, you really don't need veil piercing. Veil piercing is a situation, I believe, and I think that's what Belvedere was referring to, where the shareholder is doing these kinds of activities and depriving the corporation from being able to pay the judgment or the plaintiff.
It's more than just bringing in the controlling shareholders because the corporation acted badly.
That's correct. Otherwise, you have vitiated limited liability. What you have is control and an act of the corporation.
So they're controlling by manipulating the assets to make them unreachable or unattainable by someone who has a legal right to those. Is that basically what would have to happen?
Yes, Your Honor. I think that's the typical case, is where the shareholder has manipulated, used its control to take assets, take monies, take property in a way that deprives the plaintiff of the remedy it would get for getting a judgment or for having a claim on the underlying claim. Sorry that I didn't mention I wanted to reserve 3 minutes, and I apologize for that, but 3 minutes of rebuttal. Because, as we were talking, because this Belvedere test was intended to strike a balance between the principle of limited liability and the reality that shareholders not use that principle for their own misdeeds, I think that Belvedere clearly requires more than an act of the corporation. It requires some kind of act of the controlling shareholder. And that's what this court was doing in that second element of Belvedere. It was saying here there must be an act by a misdeed, if you will, by the controlling shareholder.
Counsel,
under the bail,
Justice Wright laid out a three-pronged test in Belvedere. But there wasn't a huge amount of discussion in Belvedere. He points out that this is a subject that hadn't been addressed by this court for a long period of time, and then he discusses that he thinks the Sixth Circuit got it right and sort of parrots that. So is it really fair that's a case about condominium owners and their fight with the developer. And that's what most of the case is about. Is it fair to imply that this court thought through all the permeations and problems of when and when you don't pierce the corporate veil in Belvedere?
Well,
that was a small part of the case, wasn't it?
Well, it was one of the issues, and it was separately addressed by the court.
Right.
And
in a clear and concise fashion.
And it clearly, I would read it, I would submit that it clearly was intended to articulate a test. It said, we're going to adopt this test to balance this doctrine of limited liability with the reality that controlling shareholders sometimes do misdeeds. It specifically found that it reversed the piercing, the individual liability, specifically finding that the proof was missing on an essential element, which was the control by the shareholder in a fraudulent manner. So if I understand your question, Your Honor, I would say, you're not thinking of every permutation,
I guess what I'm suggesting is that's what this case is all about. So when we write on this case and decide this case, we will be thinking just about the issue and what the boundaries ought to be and what the rules ought to be. Justice Wright laid out three guidelines, but I wouldn't think that Belvedere just absolutely. We look at that and say, oh, that's the end of it.
That may be true, Your Honor. I would suggest that Belvedere does control this case, but what I would also say to you that is even if you were saying, okay, we're going to reassess this case, we're going to reassess piercing, what the veil piercing test, if you will, or analysis that was used by the Court of Appeals here clearly is leaving out an essential element, because without a misdeed or a separate act by the controlling shareholder, what you have is control and the act of the shareholder. And at that point, if that's sufficient, then there is no meaning left to limited liability, which is what Belvedere was saying. You have to have a balancing test. And this court has typically and consistently said that piercing is an exception to the doctrine of limited liability.
Oh, but I think
this test that it was applied by the Court of Appeals here makes it no longer a narrow exception. It makes it the rule in any case where you have a sole shareholder, be that an individual or a corporation.
I think Mr. Palmer would argue that that a decision in his favor could be much more limited than you suggest, that if shareholder Corporation A establishes Corporation B as a means of denying claims, insurance claims, medical insurance claims that may appear on their face to be valid claims, and that there's a pattern for that. That's the reason that Corporation B was established by Corporation A, that would be a much more limited application of a modified problem with. Is, of course, the certified question is Belvedere. I mean, it asks us to apply or interpret Belvedere, the second paragraph. So we're a little, unless we want to just go off the certified question, we're a little constricted here, are we not?
If I understand the question, Your Honor, I think, no, they're asking more here. They're saying if there's
Well, they may be asking more, but you're suggesting what the result may be if we do not apply the words of Belvedere as strictly as Mr. Palmer would ask us to apply them. I mean, it seems to me that it could even be argued under Belvedere, under the illegal word in the Belvedere test, that if we have the situation I just described, the purpose of establishing the second corporation is to have a means of just simply denying claims that would appear to be valid claims to most people, that could be a breach of a contract, and therefore illegal. Now, nobody's argued that, but because it's all been assumed, it seems, that illegal means something more than that, that it's a violation of statute or criminal violation. But could a court not say that a plan that in effect would deny one's rights under a contract that in which they had engaged in a rather organized pattern could fit the illegal term in Belvedere? If you haven't thought about that.
Yeah, yes, I think
answer.
I have thought about it. I'll at least try to answer your question if I understand it. I think, Your Honor, first of all, I don't think that's really what's alleged in the complaint.
They want more than that. I agree.
They haven't alleged that. What they've alleged is there was a policy. It was a neutral policy. It was a policy of a corporation above the insurance company here, and that is sufficient to pierce. That's number one. Number two, I think that the focus has to be on who is the actor that you're looking at in terms of piercing. If it's the corporate, you don't need a piercing claim if the corporation has done something wrong and can provide a remedy. And in your hypothetical, and we taking it for a moment outside the insurance context even, if what you have is a situation where two corporations did wrongful acts, you don't need piercing. You have direct liability. Again, that is not what's alleged here.
Well, unless that corporation doesn't have any assets.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Unless that corporation doesn't have any assets, then there's an issue, is there not? Isn't that what the purpose of...
But if the two corporations independently did wrongs so that you have direct claims, not piercing claims, then you have two corporations you could get a remedy from. But that's not this case. This is a piercing case in which they're saying there doesn't have to be any wrongful misdeed by the controlling shareholder. I think my time is up. Thank you.
Mr. Palmer.
Mr. Chief Justice, Justices, it pleases the court, counsel. I wisely adopt the Chief's argument with respect to this point. This point being.
It's only hypothetical.
Indeed.
Might be a trap door.
The hypothetical, as I understand it to be, is this is more than enforcing a judgment situation. Piercing the corporate veil is an equitable remedy. And you have to start there. It's an equitable remedy. And why is it applicable here? Perfect situation, because what we have WellPoint, the parent, owns all these subsidiaries, Anthem Insurance Companies, Inc., owns CIC, Community Insurance Company. It issued the policy and owns the company that actually took care of the adjusting, Anthem UM Services, Inc. But it starts at the top. This is a top-down driven business. WellPoint establishes all the policies and procedures, and they control, own 100%, fundamentally indistinguishable from any of these other corporations. Excuse me, they conduct their business through these corporations. How?
Have you sued the two corporations that had the contracts directly?
There is one that has the contract directly, Your Honor, and that is CIC, or Community Insurance, and yes, we sued them.
Is there an issue of collectability? Is there an issue that you won't have a sufficient assets to satisfy your judgment if you get a judgment against them?
We're in a 12B6 situation, but I would suggest to the court, as far as I know, it has assets, at least it's reported to be. But the problem is, if I may, that cause for an equitable solution here of piercing the corporate veil is that CIC did nothing other than issue the policy. It did not adjudicate the claim. WellPoint had its other subsidiary
Which you could
also. UM Services, Inc.,
is there any
with whom I have no, my client has no relationship at all.
If they made the decision on your policy, why is there no relationship? They were the claims adjuster?
Because the policy was written by CIC. And the position has been, I only have privity with CIC. Thereby, the relationship out of which the duty of good faith arises, that you can sue an insurance company for what? An unjust, unjustifiable denial is against CIC. And so what WellPoint has effectively done is created a bunch of corporations behind whose veils it wishes to hide when it controls the conduct of denying the claim in this case.
I guess
case.
I don't understand why you wouldn't have a claim against CIC for breach of contract if they issue
because
the policy.
Because they did, excuse me, Your Honor.
If they issue the policy and the policy you believe, your interpretation is provides coverage and it and they deny coverage, why is your not, why, I guess I'm missing something here.
It did not deny the claim. Anthem UM Services, Inc. denied the claim.
Okay, if there's a servicer, why do you not have a direct action against them?
I have no relationship with them whatsoever. I don't have any contract
denied
with them.
Denied your claim, that seems like a direct relationship to me.
The claim under the insurance contract issued by a different corporation. They've asserted I don't have any privity against them.
Well, I guess I'm still having trouble understanding why, even if somebody else made the decision to deny the claim, that isn't a breach of contract with the company that issued the contract.
For sake of argument, I'll agree with you on that, but it doesn't help me with respect to the tort of bad faith, which arises out of the relationship of the insurance contract with CIC, who did nothing.
Other than deny your claim.
No, it didn't, Your Honor. That's a very important point here. Factually, CIC did not deny the claim. This other corporation behind which WellPoint wants to hide denied the claim. Pursuant to WellPoint's policies, procedures, AIC's corporate medical policies, et cetera.
Following.
So the if I'm trying to follow this as well, I'm having a little difficulty. So
right.
The CIC policy refers to this other corporation as being able to decide the claim, and CIC only writes a check or not, depending on what somebody else decides?
CIC policy does not refer to Anthem UM Services, Inc.
And then why does their decision not become the decision of CIC?
It may well, as a practical matter, it certainly does, but in the second supplement that I filed in this case, which I filed specifically for this purpose, if you look at the three denial letters, CIC is not mentioned anywhere. The insurance contract is not mentioned anywhere. It is solely from this organization called Anthem UM Services, Inc.
But your rights arise out of the CIC contract. So the fact that somebody else, you know, if I decide to build a house for you and some third party tells me that that's a shoddy house and I shouldn't be building it, that still doesn't say, oh, get me out of liability from the third party making that decision. You still can go after me for the fact that I built a shoddy house.
If you built a shoddy house, I would certainly agree with you, but CIC just issued the policy.
Well, let me ask you, this line of questioning is one's ability, a plaintiff's ability to sue some other company a part of the test for piercing corporate veil?
I think you start with the basic, you have to have a claim that you can pursue against the corporation. And then you say, oh, that corporation is really controlled by the shareholder who said what was to happen here, so I want to pierce the corporate veil to get to the actual wrongdoer. My problem is, arguably, if I argue their position once we get back to the, assuming we get back to the trial court, is that, well, you have no privity against UM Services, you have no privity against AICI, you have no privity against WellPoint, and sure, you got privity against CIC, but they didn't do anything, so we didn't come in any bad faith.
I guess the suggestion is that you just sue everybody and let some court figure it out.
No, Your Honor. I'm not suggesting that at all.
I know you're not, but I think some of the questioning suggests that. That's, I'm trying to find out exactly what, you know, the relevance, I guess, because it may affect our decision, the relevance of your client suing company A or B or not suing company C and D. Does that make any difference, I guess, in the realm of piercing corporate veils?
What Kim Dombrowski, through this action, is trying to do is to say, I have an insurance contract issued by CIC, technically in Ohio. And because of the relationship I have arising out of that insurance contract, and I believe that my claim was denied in bad faith, I want to pursue the claim of bad faith against that corporation. Well, I come to find out that that corporation didn't do anything. All these other corporations controlled by WellPoint actually did them, so I want to sue and have a remedy against, an equitable remedy against, because I'm out of no privity, against the corporations who actually did the wrongdoing. And therefore, I'm piercing the corporate veil on my bad faith claim through CIC horizontally and vertically to the actors themselves.
And since this is a 12B6 case, we don't have much except the 12B6 decision from the trial court.
Do you allege that CIC breached their contract?
Oh, yes. My complaint alleges that they are a conglomerate. They're all acting together in concert as an insurance
entity. I understand you've sued everybody, but CIC itself
breached the contract?
Yes, I did,
absolutely.
And whoever made the decision, the contract is with CIC, and if it's been breached, you have a remedy against CIC.
I believe I have a remedy against CIC. If we say that UM Services was their agent or whatever, which they have not admitted, for purposes of deciding the claim.
But if CIC relied on other parties' advice to breach your contract, you could establish bad faith against your own carrier.
Had they done the bad acts, I would agree. But they didn't do the bad acts.
If somebody else does the bad acts, that gets the corporation out of liability?
No, I think they're liable, and you pierce to the people who controlled it and through their control did the wrong or the bad act. And I think a wrong is certainly an unjust act, and I think that's consistent with what this court was dealing with in Belvedere. Because a wrong, if you look it up, often includes a tort. And clearly, we're not talking about any tort, any situation. We're talking only about a situation where a controlling shareholder, and there's really no dispute about that here, takes the action through their control and acts in such a manner to commit what? A wrong or an unjust act.
Is this case here prematurely? Because I'm really having trouble struggling with your theory of getting to the corporation and why you don't have liability on CIC. Do we perhaps need to let the facts develop and then let it come back on appeal when we really have some facts to flesh it out? Because you keep blaming a sort of an anonymous third party for these decisions that somehow don't let you go after the corporation that breached the contract, and I'm having trouble why that should be allow you to pierce a corporate veil.
Your Honor, first I'd submit that they're not anonymous at all. They're all parties to this lawsuit, and that the documents and evidencing the denials were attached to the complaint and are part of the second supplement.
Take my word anonymous back. You know who they are. But it's some third party that you claim you can't get to because your company you're going after isn't going to be liable for their action somehow.
I'm here because WellPoint and the AICI convinced the trial court that I had no privity and they threw me out. And then the Court of Appeals said, well, you asserted piercing the corporate veil, an equitable remedy against these people. You're in as to piercing the corporate veil. And the reason we're here now is strictly, as the Chief pointed out a little bit ago, we're on a certified question. And technically the only question, as I understand the rules, is before the court is whether fraud and illegal act, as the words chosen in Belvedere, includes wrongs and unjust acts and inequitable acts like the Sixth Circuit discussed.
So your theory is that a breach of contract by the parent corporation, well, that doesn't even work. If the parent corporation has something to do with getting the party you that is in direct privity with you to breach their contract, that gets you ability to pierce the corporate veil? I'm having trouble understanding your theory.
I'm saying, Your Honor, that if the parent corporation that controls the subsidiary corporation uses that control to commit the tort of insurance bad faith, a wrong, an unjust act, yes, I ought to be able to pierce the corporate veil of its subsidiary to get to them since they're the ones who did the actual.
So, counsel, the only question that we have is the unjust or inequitable behavior equal to a level of fraud or an illegal act as defined or put forth in Belvedere? That's all we need to decide here, right?
That's the certified question, and that's what I tried to brief. And I would submit only that the answer lies in Belvedere itself. It lies there if you look at the syllabus. It starts out by saying, what are we doing? We're trying to prevent shareholders from hiding behind the corporate veil from what? From doing wrong. The word is used as wrong. In the opinion, it says misdeed. In the syllabus, it says wrong. And if you look at prong one, it says you got to be control. Control is not enough. That's what Rourke was in control in Belvedere, but that wasn't enough. So what's prong two all about? Did Rourke use his control to do wrong? Prong two. Answer to that question on those facts? No. No evidence he did wrong. No piercing the corporate veil. These facts, I submit that the tort of bad faith is a wrong which is encompassed within this equitable remedy, certainly within the words of unjust and inequitable, and in any event, results in an inequitable result, which the courts find is a reason to pierce the corporate veil. And three is the proximate cause. Did that cause the plaintiff any harm? And very significantly, I think, in the syllabus, it says, in essence, not in essence, I will quote it. It says on prong three that unjust loss resulted to the plaintiff from what? Such control, prong one, and what? Wrong, prong two. We're not talking about legitimate corporate acts here. We're talking about somebody does something wrong. And the tort of bad faith is certainly something wrong in the equitable sense. The whole tort itself arises out of trying to level the playing field between insurance companies and consumers. It's a fairness kind of tort. It's an equitable kind of tort. And that's the wrong which I seek to pierce on.
Counsel, I guess part of the problem is the term unjust or inequitable has a pretty elastic meaning. Mm-hmm. And, you know, people do unjust and inequitable things every day that don't arise to some level of cognizable level of wrong for which a recovery is permitted. And so I guess my question is, what is your meaning of the term limited to some sort of, you know, recognizable tort? Or are we talking to much broader terms than that? I mean, one is, you know, fraud. I mean, that's pretty clear. You can sort of put your hands around that, but unjust and inequitable. How far are you taking that?
Well, I think that's the inherent issue in an equitable remedy, number one. As the Sixth Circuit in the conversion case said, it needs to be and has been a flexible remedy. It's not like we're trying to list, and as Judge Pfeiffer says, think of every situation that it might apply to. It has to be somewhat flexible as a result. And interestingly, with respect to fraud, one of the law articles that counsel cites, this Millen article, says on the very same page that they cite in their brief, but don't include this, fraud is apparently intended in a more general sense to mean bad faith or unfairness rather than the deliberate dishonesty, which it would also obviously include. I think the cases out of the courts of appeals have been pretty clear with to dealing with your question, Justice, and that is, you know, what is inequitable in the situation. And clearly these abuse of the corporate form kinds of situations, taking the money and putting it in your pocket, taking the money and building your house, whatever. Clearly stuff like that there are many cases that say that. If you form the corporation for an illegal act, clearly, I mean, you got the situation.
But counsel, if you're gonna concentrate on something that's inequitable or unfair, doesn't that open the floodgates to just a number of cases or lawsuits by the perception that I'm being treated inequitably or unfairly?
First, in the broad sense, certainly, and that's not the intent
and
of the remedy. And
I know you have the other two prongs
right
to address. And
that was going
to
be my point.
I understand that. But, yeah, you got a parent corporation, and that's not unusual to have a parent corporation that controls many subsidiary corporations. So that's not an unusual situation. And then you've got to say that basically this parent corporation has mandated an unfair policy or practice, and that has detriment to the individual, the person who perceives themselves as a victim. That's a pretty low standard, in my opinion.
That seems to me to be a very high standard to be able to prove that, because you have to show that the controlling shareholder, through its corporation, the corporation did something wrong, and that its control was exercised so as to cause the corporation, its subsidiary corporation, to commit a wrong.
Well, you're wrong, though, is based on a perception you said could include just a unfairness, that nebulous term of unfairness.
That was their expert law review article that said that. I'm suggesting the same language that was in Bucyrus that has been picked up in the Taylor case and the conversion case of the Sixth Circuit after Belvedere included the words wrong, unjust, and dishonest. I think that's what Bucyrus talked about. That, I think, was the approach, as the court said, that this court adopted. I think the answer lies in those decisions and in the decisions interpreting Belvedere by the Sixth Circuit. The Taylor court said specifically that in reviewing all the decisions of the Ohio Courts of Appeals that we've all cited, that it's apparent that the courts of Ohio believe that fraud and illegal act encompasses both criminal and serious civil wrongs. I submit to this court that a serious civil wrong is the tort of insurance bad faith, and it's no easy matter to succeed in that.
Well, if we were to say insurance bad faith, we would not be really talking about simply unjust or inequitable acts. Would you agree with that?
I would agree with that.
All right.
There has to be an element of dishonesty. That would be my perception, that there's an intentional dishonesty, misrepresentation, something more than just a perceived wrong or unfairness.
Well, in the Grange case, they didn't get approval for a rate and were charging policyholders a higher rate. That was technically illegal, and they said, well, we're not going to reimburse the difference until they were sued. Was that dishonest? Perhaps, if you will use the term very loosely, but that's certainly not an abuse of the corporate form. The Tri-State case where the guy violated his EPA permits because he wasn't reporting things right. That wasn't any kind of sort of dishonest in the sense of pocketing money.
Well, of course, counsel on the other side is saying that these appellate decisions have been very flexible and very loose in their interpretation of the second section of Belvedere.
I certainly understand that's their position. I think their position is fundamentally wrong, because what they want this court to say is that the shareholder has to do something wrong to cause the corporation to do something wrong that wrongs the plaintiff. And that's not what prong two says. Prong two says the controlling shareholder causes its subsidiary corporation to do something wrong, and three, it has to proximately cause what? An unjust loss. That's what Belvedere says, an unjust loss.
Counsel, I wonder if we could talk just a moment about this sort of the floodgate argument, but that presupposes that in fact one corporation or the shareholder is controlling the corporation to the sense that they become alter egos, and a remedy to this floodgate argument that's raised in opposition to your proposition is that you simply operate them as independent entities, right? Don't be alter egos. That would solve the
problem. That would solve the problem, exactly. But when the situation is an alter ego, then there's this very historical and not very often successfully used remedy of piercing the corporate veil. I mean, many of the cases, including Rourke, found there wasn't any remedy there because why? The evidence didn't show that he controlled.
You've used,
his personal influence. Thank you very much.
Ms. Richards, you've used your time, but you may start with a minute.
Thank you. You
gave Mr. Palmer substantially more than 15 minutes.
Just a few short points. First of all, just to clarify, The insurance company CIC that issued the policy was sued here. No 12B6 made on behalf of it. OMSI, that Mr. Palmer referred to, is used to help administer the claims of CIC. It was sued. No 12B6.
And
it
they
is
remain
in the,
in the case.
Pardon me?
They
it remains in the case. We're talking about we're talking about those being direct and indirect subs of the two parties that were dismissed, number one. Number two, I think that Mr. Palmer clearly told you that what he's suggesting is that you have control and you have the corporation doing something unjust. And when you have that test, you have done away with limited liability for small corporations, closely held corporations, or any situation in which there's a sole shareholder. Because if you're showing control and then saying that the act of the corporation becomes the act of the shareholder, you have vitiated, which is exactly what the court did in this case, limited liability. Three, it's the Belvedere test talked about the exercise of control by the shareholder. It did not talk about, thank you very much, it did not talk about the act of the corporation. And that's really the nub of this, is that using the term unjust or inequitable consequences has caused the courts of appeals to look at the act of the corporation, not the act of the controlling shareholder, the exercise of control. And accordingly, as in this case, limited liability is vitiated. For that reason, we say, please say no to the certified question. Please reverse the Court of Appeals on this. Please give meaning to limited liability in Ohio. Please give meaning to a narrow exception, but it should not become the rule. Or there will be, as just Judge Cobain said in Imperial Construction, no way for sole shareholders, small companies, to exist.
Ms. Richards, the question of bad faith, though, how would you interface that with the second prong regarding a fraud or illegal act? If it were limited solely to bad faith, allowing the parent corporation or the shareholder to exercise control and commit bad faith, which then caused an unjust injury or an unjust loss?
Your Honor, I think that a bad faith case is no different than any other case, a fraud case, a very bad act. I think you look at, okay, did the corporation, CIC in this case, and OMSI, commit bad faith? Was there a bad faith denial? That'll be decided under the underlying claim. Let's assume for a moment that there was. That doesn't mean that the controlling shareholder, simply by virtue of control, becomes responsible for that bad faith.
The problem is that 12B6, the plaintiff hasn't had a chance to attempt to prove that there was this connection, this control that I agree. I mean, I think you've really helped us focus on it's the control of the major shareholder that's at issue, exercise of that control, but he hasn't had a chance to prove any of that, has he?
He's not alleged it, Your Honor. That's the point here in terms of the 12B6. He alleged control, and then he alleged that the corporation committed bad faith. He's not alleging that WellPoint fraudulently controlled, illegally controlled, did something wrong that subverted the corporate form so that it should not have the protection of the corporate form.
So he's alleging that WellPoint controlled CIC and that CIC committed bad faith against the plaintiff?
That's really what the allegation is.
Or is it that WellPoint committed bad faith exercising control over CIC?
No, he's not alleged that. He's alleged you have control. WellPoint controls CIC. He's alleged CIC has denied this claim wrongfully.
Not even and CIC, actually. It's this other company that's not referred to in the policy.
It's an administrative entity, but
yeah, some company can't quite get your hand on it because they've got the control.
It's a party here, and it's not been dismissed, and we agree that it's part of the CIC process. But CIC is, as Justice Stratton pointed out, CIC has a contract. If it's breached and if it's in bad faith, they have a claim against it. And if it used a third party, an agent, to do some of the processing, that doesn't change that fact. But to get to your point, you have CIC controlled by WellPoint. That's been assumed for purposes of this 12B6. Okay. What I believe they are saying, and what the only thing they've alleged is, that AICI, actually is the allegation, had a medical policy that was utilized by CIC and OMC in denying the claim. And the mere fact that that policy is a corporate policy is enough to allow piercing. Now, that really does vitiate limited liability. I mean, you have parents' corporations, in order to actually promote adherence to the law, doing all kinds of policies, EEO policies, policies against sexual harassment, policies against guns on premises. And if you're saying that the fact that a sole shareholder, whether it be a corporation or an individual, implements a policy that the corporation then applies in a variety of individual cases, including Ms. Dombrowski, and that's enough to pierce, then there really is no distinction made between the corporation and the shareholder.
Counsel, let me take you down to the practical issues here, because we're all trying to figure out how does one who believes they've been wronged have an opportunity at achieving substantial justice by presenting a case. So CIC is there. They issued the policy, they're there.
Right.
It's alleged that a covered claim, what should be a covered claim, is denied payment by CIC.
Correct.
Because of policies of a non-party parent. Is what's going to be the position of CIC when Mr. Palmer tries to depose the officers and employees of the non-party parent when Mr. Palmer tries to show what the policies in fact were that were in place that controlled the outcome of the corporation that's there? In other words, to show the bad faith, If the parent company is not in this case, or the other sub that he alleges is controlling things, is CIC, and can you represent to us that the lawyers for CIC are going to permit the discovery from these parent corporations or these collateral corporations of the issues that they allege have taken place?
Well, let me make sure that I answer your question. First of all,
my question is, how do you prove your case if you don't have these other people a crack at them?
You don't need CIC adopted a policy that was handed down by a parent. It denied a claim pursuant to its policy in effect. It didn't formulate it, perhaps, but it's a CIC decision using OMSI to deny this claim. Now, with regard to the parent here, if I understand your question.
My question is, I think his case is, CIC, they've got a rule book there. It says claim denied, boom. But he's saying that's wrong. It's unjust.
But his claim then is against CIC.
There's bad faith, whatever term you want to use, involved in this that comes from a higher authority. And my question is, how is he going to get to prove that?
Your Honor,
If CIC
made a decision pursuant to a medical policy that is a CIC policy formulated by someone else, but I guess what I'm struggling with, Your Honor, is this.
If I'm a sole shareholder
of this corporation, I'm an individual.
Okay.
The case is Allegiant, that alone isn't enough. Control alone isn't enough. But of course, I write out a policy because I'm the officer of the corporation, and I write out a policy. And that policy is adopted now by my corporation. It's the act of the corporation at that point. I've done the normal formalities. I've not exercised any control in any wrongful way.
But the lady at the corporation said, I read from the book, it says no. I didn't fudge. That's what the book says. Now, Mr. Palmer is saying, this isn't the tablets that Moses brought down from the mountain. This was formulated by somebody up the corporate chain in a different corporation. He wants to prove that. Now, if they're not in the case, are you going to let him prove that?
Your Honor, if they're not in the case, they have to be in the case one of two ways. Number one, there's a direct claim. They issued a policy. They're the real insurance company, and there's no allegation of that here. Or number two, they have alleged enough, and ultimately will be able to discover and prove enough, that there should be piercing. That it's not the bad faith claim that you're looking at that point.
Okay, I don't care
about
piercing.
That's done by the corporation.
I don't care about piercing. Let's say you don't get to pierce, but you do get to haul in the folks that said to CIC, you can't pay these claims, and find out why they put that policy together. But they work for another corporation. You're not piercing a corporate veil. Are you going to permit that?
Well, I guess I'm having trouble, Your Honor. I'll be honest with you, because I don't. Yeah, you can get discovery against a non-party under the civil rules. So yes.
Counsel, is it important who made up that policy? If CIC has adopted it as its own, has an adjuster that goes out and assesses it, comes back and says, "Here's what the situation is." CIC says, "According to our policy, she's not eligible for this experimental procedure."
Correct.
So they own it. They own the policy. They own the
CIC
procedure.
It's a CIC policy. Yes. So it's no different than if I'm a corporation and I find a EEO policy in a book and I copy it and I make it my policy. I don't believe a plaintiff sues the publisher of that book. It is my policy at that point. Where I got it from is immaterial in terms of being able to pierce or go above or find liability for someone else, I believe. That's what I would submit, Your Honor.
Thank you, Ms. Richards.
Thank you very much.
Case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. Take a brief recess.